You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Emma Nelson on the 30th of August 2013.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we find out what three stories are set to dominate the day's agenda. Joining us to do just that is Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck. Oscar, what do you have?
Today we have the Peace, War and Protest Report from the United Kingdom in Europe to Colombia in South America.
Wow, what a spread. Also on the programme, South Africa is bracing itself for nationwide strikes that might cripple its already struggling economy. Might we see a repeat of the Marikana massacre?
And forget a 4am fat boy burger. We visit the world of 24-hour gourmet vending machines.
There's a machine staying in front of our shop. You can entrance 24 hours, 7 days. And in this machine, you don't get money out of the wall, but you get 10 different present packages in a culinary style.
And
lives are shattered. The nation is in chaos. Death and destruction sweeps the country.
It's the attack of the killer piranhas, mutated cavemen and sharktopus. Just another day in the world of B-movies.
We'll be paying tribute to Roger Corman a little later on. All that plus we play some music too. That's all ahead in the next hour here on Midori House.
Two minutes past eight here in the studio in London. As ever, we have a packed show for you ahead. But first of all, let's catch up on the headlines from around the world with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. UN weapons inspectors say they should conclude their work to establish whether or not chemical weapons have been used in Syria today. They're expected to hand their findings to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at the weekend. Veto-holding members of the United Nations are divided over a draft Security Council resolution that would authorize all necessary force in response to an alleged gas attack in Syria. In a parliamentary vote yesterday, British MPs rejected possible UK military action against Syria to deter the use of chemical weapons. US State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf says President Barack Obama may go ahead with military action against Syria without Allied support.
The only party in Syria that's prevented the UN from investigating is the regime. So we have called on the regime from day one to allow unfettered access. The opposition from day one has said they will allow the investigation team to areas that they control. So there's only one group in Syria today that has not allowed the UN team to investigate, and that's the regime.
Meanwhile, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, has been visiting a Syrian refugee camp in Iraq's northern semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan. He's urged Syria's neighbouring countries to help people fleeing the civil war.
A collapse of many of the state institutions and an enormous suffering of the people, those that are killed and those that have to flee in all directions. And in these circumstances, the most important contribution a country can give to this humanitarian drama is to keep the borders open for those in need of protection.
Egyptian officials say a leading member of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohammed el-Beltaji, has been arrested. According to state media, Mr. Beltaji, who's Secretary General of the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, is accused of inciting violence. Former Labour Minister Khaled al-Azari was also held. The arrests are part of the Egyptian military's moves against Brotherhood leaders following the ousting of former President Mohamed Morsi. Police in Mexico have arrested the suspected lieutenant of the country's most wanted drugs lord on suspicion of murdering hundreds of people. Mario Nunez, a former police officer, is thought to be the operations chief of Joaquin Guzman in Chihuahua, a state bordering the United States, which has been dominated by drug-related violence over the past few years. Mario Nunez is believed to be responsible for the murder of more than 350 people recovered from 23 hidden mass graves. Joaquin Guzman is head of the Sinaloa cartel, thought to be the country's most powerful drug-running organization. Tens of thousands of people have been taken to the streets of Colombia's capital, Bogotá, in support of a strike by small-scale farmers. Some marchers have clashed with police. The farmers say the government's agricultural policies are driving them into bankruptcy. President Juan Manuel Santos says the farmers have the right to demonstrate against his government, but he called on them to reject violence. Negotiations to end the protests, which started 11 days ago, remain deadlocked. One of the biggest canyons in the world has been found beneath the ice sheet that covers most of Greenland. The canyon, which is 800 kilometres long and up to 800 metres deep, was carved out by a river more than 4 million years ago, before the ice arrived. It was discovered by accident as scientists researching climate change mapped Greenland's bedrock by radar. The Hidden Valley is longer than the Grand Canyon in Arizona. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. Bill will be back in about 24 minutes or so to bring us a quick roundup of the news. In the meantime, though, it's 6 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House.
Well, it is time now on Midori House for us to choose the stories that will dominate the news agenda this Friday. And joining us to do just that in the studio is Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University. A very good morning and welcome to the show, Oscar. Great to have you with us, as always. So, Syria, obviously a huge, huge story in every single paper this morning. It's top of your agenda. Tell us more.
Absolutely. Yesterday, British MPs voted down a government attempt to secure provisional authorization for military intervention in Syria. The motion was defeated by a majority of 13 votes. Prime Minister David Cameron said it was clear. Parliament does not want action and the government will act accordingly.
This is astonishing. This is a huge departure from the way that the United Kingdom has decided to go to war in the past.
Absolutely true. Not only it is a huge blow to the Prime Minister's authority in the Commons, but it changes constitutional law. Effectively, Parliament has now taken up war powers for itself, which means that in the future it's going to be very, very difficult for a prime minister to go to war without Parliament's authorization.
Mr. Cameron looked suitably emotional last night as all of this was going on. Essentially, though, was this more about a vote on Iraq, a kind of retrograde expression of mass regret in the Commons as to what had happened when we invaded Iraq, or was this really about Syria?
I think it's both things. There is no doubt whatsoever that the shadow of Iraq looms largely upon this issue. And yesterday was definite proof of that. But it is also the case that the British public feels that it may be, that it is being lied to once more. The so-called dossier, actually the dossier that wasn't called a dossier, looked as dodgy as the previous one. There was no causal link between the chemical attack and the Assad regime actually having carried the attack. All of these things made people very wary, and clearly MPs were responding to their constituents' feelings.
It makes me wonder whether it was a question of timing, because the UN chemical weapons inspectors are due to finish their job either today or tomorrow. The United States has already slightly jumped the gun and said they believe that Assad was behind the chemical attacks. Had perhaps Parliament waited until next week, when it was due to come back anyway, with the UN report in its hand, do you think the result might have been different?
Well, maybe, but actually, surprisingly enough, yesterday another motion was voted down, and that motion actually pointed out that if proof was given by UN inspectors, then there would be a military attack. What was voted down is precisely this sort of automatism in between the problem there and the military response. What Parliament doesn't want is that kind of automatism ever again.
I know that behind closed doors in Whitehall this week, it was widely assumed that Britain would be accompanying the US in military action against Syria from as early as tomorrow. What happens now? And are there going to be tense words between Obama and Cameron once Obama wakes up?
I'm sure Obama woke up will wake up with a big headache today, because it is also the case that in spite of the huge pressure upon Obama in the US to go to war from the usual hawks, there isn't an appetite for war in America either. And now the prospect of going at it alone although it might be the last case scenario, is not precisely what the US administration wanted.
Where does the UN now lie with this? Because obviously the United Kingdom put forward a resolution that now it will not be able to act upon, and that, you know, no matter what happens. But there have been accusations that the UN has been fairly toothless in the run-up to this, that it's done everything it can bar actually take action. We've heard sort of lukewarm protests from Russia. We actually haven't had Russia come out and say any action against Syria would be an international war crime. So perhaps there is a little bit of room for manoeuvre here. And as has been said, I think we mentioned on Monocle 24 yesterday, the UN isn't an independent body. It is actually the sum total of a lot of countries which have to work together. So where do you think the UN could now push things?
Actually, this may be a huge win for the United Nations insofar as its authority as the only body which can authorize the use of force has been confirmed. And as you pointed out correctly, there is plenty of room for maneuver. It isn't the case that Russia has been totally unreasonable. They actually have watered down their claims. And I suspect that if we have enough evidence, at the very least, these would oblige the US, the UK, Russia and Iran to work together to bring Assad back to the negotiation table, which is what everybody has been asking for. Hans Blix put it correctly yesterday when he said that there isn't room for the West to act as global policemen. That just cannot happen in international law. But there is room for all these big powers to use their influence upon the Assad regime.
And as a result, just asking that the fact that the parliament in Britain yesterday voted against the principle of intervention in Syria, where does that leave them when it comes to, let's say, a UN security resolution is passed saying action must be taken? What does the UK do then?
Well, it would be different if there is a Chapter 7 authorization for member countries to use force. But I have the impression that now the diplomatic route is the one that will have to be followed first.
Oscar, we should move on, but I'm sure we'll be coming back to the story a lot over the next coming days and weeks. Let's talk about Colombia now.
Yeah, this is the peace part of our War and Peace report. A week of peaceful protests by peasants raising their voice against the consequences of trade liberalization has pushed the government of Colombia into a corner. These are the kinds of social protests that we had seen in Brazil and Chile in previous months have now moved into neighboring Colombia. But this one is particularly interesting because so far, most opinion in the mainstream media was that these were some sort of middle-class protests. This one confirms that hasn't been the case. Now we have low-scale farmers, peasants, leading the protests, and then urban organizations, students, trade unions joining forces with them. And yesterday we saw thousands of people, taking to the streets of the main cities in Colombia. Negotiations between government and peasants are at a deadlock. And this is becoming a very, very interesting phenomenon in Latin America. Social protests from below actually driving the political agenda.
Oscar, thank you very much indeed. We'll have to leave it there. That was Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University.
Coming up, nationwide strikes in South Africa. How devastating will the impact be on the economy? Stay with us.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibaken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
The
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Emma Nelson. Now, Africa's biggest economy is preparing for a high-stakes showdown between capital and labour as members of the National Union of Mine Workers intend to strike over deadlocked wage talks. Affecting one of South Africa's principal industries, gold mining, producers are now bracing themselves for the prospect of a complete shutdown across the sector, starting as early as Sunday night. According to calculations based on the spot price of gold, that could cost the economy up to $35 million per day in lost output.
This would come at a time when South Africa's economy is already struggling in the wake of strikes affecting other sectors, for example, from the auto manufacturing industry to construction and aviation. Now representatives of the gold miners are seeking wage increases of around 60%. Some more militant unions want as much as 150%. However, the country's Chamber of Mines' final offer was much lower, of around 6%. So we are at a stalemate. To discuss what this means for South Africa and its economy, we're joined on the line now by Kevin Allison, who's global resources columnist for Thomson Reuters. Welcome to the programme, Kevin. This strike is due to begin in the next 48 hours. Is the effect going to be as serious as many are predicting?
Well, if you compare the strike situation this year with last year's labour unrest in South Africa, there are some slightly hopeful signs. Last year, as you might recall, a striking workers at a Lonmin platinum mine in South Africa were gunned down by police. There was terrible violence. It left, in the end, about 50 people dead. This year's round of wage talks, these are biannual wage talks, haven't seen the same kind of violence. The two main unions in the mines that have been negotiating with the mining companies have been trying to adhere to a more structured process than last year. That's the hopeful sign. The problem is, as you said, the offer that the gold miners have put forward is a 6% wage increase, and the lower offer of the two unions wants 60%. The more militant union wants 150%. So the two sides are still far apart, and it comes at a vulnerable time for South Africa because its economy is struggling to grow, and this is not going to help investment if the country is seen as continuing to have fraught labour tensions.
This kind of labour, prolonged labour unrest, as you say, is presumably raising questions about Jacob Zuma, the ANC president, and his government to manage what are increasing social tensions in South Africa. As you say, it's a very vulnerable time. Obviously, huge amounts of poverty and inequality and unemployment affecting so many South Africans and playing into this labour unrest. Where does it leave the government at this point?
Well, this is the heart of the matter. The ANC, which has dominated South African national politics since the end of apartheid, has become, in many ways, an ossified single-party government, and it's not been delivering on some of its promises. The promise with the end of apartheid was that South Africa might be able to create a new society with a vibrant middle class. There was talk 10 years ago of South Africa perhaps deserving to be included in the BRIC emerging countries along with Brazil, Russia, India, China. It hasn't really worked out that way. There's been some progress economically among a very narrow sliver of black elite South Africans. But for the vast majority of people, they're still struggling with the same or even in some cases in the bottom 20% of the income ladder in South Africa, worse economic conditions than they endured under apartheid. There's massive unemployment. People have very few prospects. People still live in a kind of ghettoized fashion, not really well integrated into the more kind of economically advanced part of South African society. And as long as this continues, I think, the ANC still seems to have a grip on the country. There doesn't seem to be really a formidable opposition that might be able to topple it in the polls, but meanwhile, the country is stagnating, and this kind of labor strike, a potentially much wider labor unrest than you've seen just in the mining sector, but also including, as you said, petrol stations, other areas. It really risks putting South Africa into a vicious circle of unrest, underinvestment, and unemployment.
Now, these strikers say that the miners say that they are prepared to strike for up to 3 months and at a cost of, what, $35 million per day. That's their sort of estimate. This obviously could be incredibly damaging to the South African economy. Last time, following the Marikana massacre, Standard & Poor's downgraded South Africa. I mean, to what degree is even the prospect of further industrial action and further unrest within the gold mining industry going to damage South Africa's reputation?
Well, I think it certainly does damage it. The level of uncertainty in South Africa is very high. If you were an international company thinking about moving a factory to Africa, South Africa probably wouldn't be your first choice of country to move it to. And I think that's really saying something. The miners, the sector is a large sector, but it accounts for about 5% of South African GDP. Where it really matters is in exports. It's a big part of South African exports. And that leads to concerns over time if the mining sector is struggling about, and meanwhile, the government is very inefficient, it leads to concerns about the trade deficit and government finances. And so it's understandable why you think the rating agencies might be concerned about what they're seeing in South Africa.
Kevin, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for your insights this morning. Kevin Allison, Global Resources columnist for Thomson Reuters. Thanks for joining us here on Midori House.
Past the hour here in London now. He's won an Academy Award and enjoys critical acclaim from the likes of the Cinémathèque Française. But Roger Corman is perhaps best known for the low-budget B-movies he churned out with remarkable speed in the early 1960s. The Little Shop of Horrors, Piranha, The Intruder. Corman's films are packed with wobbly flying saucers, splendidly awful rubber costumes, and women with pneumatic chests.
The title of Corman's autobiography, How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime, perhaps sums up his approach to filmmaking. And now a new book has been published about Corman and his work. It's called Crab Monsters, Teenage Cavemen and Candy-Striped Nurses, Roger Corman, King of the B-Movie. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to its author, Chris Nashawaty, a little earlier.
So Chris, my first question, for those who don't know who is Roger Corman, can you explain to us what's his relevance to the film industry?
Sure. I mean, I think Roger Corman is probably the least known, most influential figure in Hollywood over the past half century. He started in 1954 as a producer. He directed about 50 films, and he produced about 400 more. Most of the films were what you'd call B-movies, which means they played in drive-ins, and they were about monsters, or women in prison, and or killer piranha. The thing that makes him most interesting, although many of his movies were good, is that he gave the starts to so many A-list celebrities' careers. People like Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Jack Nicholson, James Cameron, Robert De Niro, Stallone, they all started off in Roger Corman movies.
And it's interesting, there's even a quote in the book about Ron Howard, that when Roger says to him, "Ron, if you do a good job for me in this picture, you'll never have to work with me again." That's quite interesting.
Yeah, that's right. It's a funny story, and Ron Howard, you know, tells it really well. Ron Howard, of course, started off his career as a child actor on The Andy Griffith Show and on Happy Days, and he wanted to get into directing. And the only way he could really do it was through someone like Roger Corman, who would allow, you know, eager, hungry young filmmakers or wannabe filmmakers, he would give them their first chance to make a film because he could hire them for cheap and make them really work their tail off. And Ron Howard got the shot to direct a car crash romp called Grand Theft Auto.
Were you always a big fan of Roger Corman?
You know, it's funny, people ask me this question all the time. I mean, I review movies for a living, and I think that when people hear that, they assume that the kinds of movies you like are the movies that win Oscars. And although I love those movies, the ones that I sort of grew up on were monster movies and horror movies and sort of the sorts of movies that your parents don't want you to watch.
And I want to talk about your book, which is fascinating. It looks great visually. You know, there's so many posters from his films. I'm seeing here the poster for Stripped to Kill, for example.
You're right.
And how did someone help you with the visual of the book?
Well, the publisher of the book, Abrams, has a really great design team. And I think a lot of the work on designing a book like this, you know, something that you can really put on your coffee table and will catch your eye, is that, you know, you have to have great art. Fortunately, Roger Corman made exploitation movies. And since they didn't have many stars, he had to make great posters. So in the case of a lot of his movies, the posters are better than the film. They're really fantastic works of art on their own.
And you also have many important people in your book as well. For example, John Landis, you know, he starts introducing the book, right?
That's right. Yeah, John Landis wrote the introduction. Of course, for those who don't know him, he directed such films as An American Werewolf in London and The Blues Brothers and National Lampoon's Animal House. I was interviewing him for this book, and I've talked to him several times over the years for other stories I've been working on my day job, which is as a writer at Entertainment Weekly magazine in New York. And talking to him, he just seemed like such a great storyteller that I thought, you know, if I could get just an ounce of that into the introduction of the book, that would really be a way to catch people right off the bat. And fortunately, he was willing to do it.
And I'm just looking here at the book. What do you think are Roger Corman's most iconic films, in your opinion? And after, if I may ask, what's your favorite as well?
Well, I think his most iconic films are also his best films, and there are a few of them. I mean, the movies that he made in the early 60s, his adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe stories, movies like House of Usher, The Mask of the Red Death, you know, those sorts of movies are really the movies that he used to graduate from being a guy who cranked out movies in 3 or 4 days to movies that actually look like real movies, and better yet, they look like works of art. They look like gothic horror films, and most of them star Vincent Price, and they're really well made. Beyond that, I think that he made a movie in the early 60s called The Intruder, which starred a very young William Shatner, long before Star Trek. And it's a very, very ahead of its time movie about segregation in the American South. And this was at a time when Hollywood didn't dare to touch such topics. They really treated race as sort of like a hot potato. And Corman, who was a liberal in his private life, really wanted to make a personal film. And that's the film he came up with. I think it's his best film. It's also the only film he ever made out of 400 that ever lost money.
I'll tell you something right here and now. It may be hot tonight, but it's going to get hotter for a whole lot of people. This here little town's going to burn. What I mean, it's going to burn the conscience of the country and put forth a light that everyone and everybody's going to see and feel. This town I'm talking about, Caxton.
I have to tell you, one of my personal favorites is Piranha, actually. And did you like Piranha?
Oh, of course. Piranha's a fantastic film. I mean, it's you know, it was created as a Jaws ripoff. It came out a couple of years after Jaws sort of redefined what a blockbuster was, and Corman wanted to cash in on that. I mean, he's a savvy businessman, and he realized that, you know, a movie like Jaws is, you know, money is left on the table, and he was there to scoop it up. So he made this movie about killer fish.
There's something strange in the water at Lost River Lake. Something you can't see. Something you can't feel until it's too late.
It was written by John Sayles, you know, a famous screenwriter long before he became famous, and it was directed by Joe Dante, who was a person who started his career cutting trailers at Roger Corman's New World Pictures.
And you know, you, in the book, like you go through Roger's career, and it's interesting to note that in the 80s, you know, with the introduction of VHS, that actually helped him quite a lot, because, I mean, he didn't have space anymore in mainstream cinemas, but then you have this huge market on the home entertainment, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was a really interesting sort of revolution in the movie business, one that the Hollywood studios were really slow to recognize. But a guy like Corman, who always had to be a little bit faster and a little bit quicker on the uptake just because he was working with much less money and had to be creative, he recognized that, you know, VHS was going to be the future. And he recognized that if you could make movies directly for video, they didn't necessarily have to be very good. You could make them cheaply. You just had to put them in a box that had either a sexy woman on the cover or a monster, just some sort of exploitation element that you could sell. And at the time, mom and pop video stores across the world were looking for titles to stock. And he just filled that gaping hole quicker than anyone and made a killing at it.
Is Roger still working? I know he just got an Oscar like a few years ago in 2009. And is he still working, or he's just kind of retired now?
Surprisingly, he is. He's in his mid-80s now, and he's putting out a couple of films a year. He has a deal with the Sci-Fi Network, which is a network that makes movies like Piranaconda and Sharknado. And Roger has really carved out a niche for himself late in his career to sort of create those movies on the cheap for this company, and they're doing really, really well. Once again, he's sort of proven that he can fill a need that no one else is filling.
And it's nice that the cinema industry is finally kind of recognizing his importance as well, especially after the Oscar.
That's true. I mean, I think the Oscar was a real recognition of the contribution he's made to movies. I mean, he was really, you know, long before there were companies like Miramax, he was the original sort of independent filmmaker. And, you know, like I said, I think he's made some really great movies on his own. But part of that legacy that can't be ignored is all the careers that he helped start. And I think that's what the Oscar was really about. Here's a guy who really recognized talent, put it to work, and gave us some of the best filmmakers and stars that we've ever had.
That was Chris Nashawaty, author of that biography of Roger Corman, Crab Monsters, Teenage Cavemen and Candy Striped Nurses, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of the programme, we get the latest news out of Belgrade and we review the morning's Italian front pages. But first, with the time just nudging 31 minutes past the hour, Bill has the latest.
UN weapons inspectors say they should conclude their work to establish whether or not chemical weapons have been used in Syria today. They're expected to hand their findings to UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon at the weekend. Veto-holding members of the United Nations are divided over a draft Security Council resolution that would authorise all necessary force in response to the alleged gas attack in Syria. In a parliamentary vote yesterday, British MPs rejected possible UK military action against the country. US officials say President Barack Obama may go ahead with military action against Syria without allied support. Egyptian officials say a leading member of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohammed El Beltaji, has been arrested. According to state media, Mr. Beltaji, who's Secretary General of the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, is accused of inciting violence. Former Labour Minister Khaled Al-Azari was also held. Police in Mexico have arrested the suspected lieutenant of the country's most wanted drugs lord on suspicion of murdering hundreds of people. Mario Nunez, a former police officer, is thought to be the operations chief of Joaquin Guzman in Chihuahua, a state bordering the United States which has been dominated by drug-related violence over the past few years. Mario Nunez is believed to be responsible for the murder of more than 350 people recovered from 23 hidden mass graves. Tens of thousands of people have been taken to the streets of Colombia's capital, Bogota, in support of a strike by small-scale farmers. Some marchers have clashed with police. The farmers say the government's agricultural policies are driving them into bankruptcy. President Juan Manuel Santos says the farmers have the right to demonstrate against his government, but he's called on everyone to reject violence. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. Bill will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of the world news, after which point you can tune in to Section D, Monocle 24's Design Hour. But in the meantime, you're back with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Clemency Burton Hill. Let's turn to this week's episode of The Menu, shall we? We'll be in Sicily, sampling some of the island's hidden delicacies. We'll discover what the gourmet ingredient is gaining popularity in Western Australia, and we meet two young entrepreneurs who are introducing ice cream sushi to the residents of Madrid. Madrid, you have my sympathies. But in this week preview, we head to Germany, where shopping for good food on a Sunday has just got slightly easier.
In Berlin, it's very difficult to be spontaneous, gastronomically speaking, on a Sunday if it involves having to buy any sort of gourmet grocery. But this summer, a new option appeared in the city, a 24/7 vending machine for gourmet food, from Himalayan sea salt to even a bit of bubbly. We sent Jessica Bridger with spare change in hand to sample some of the delights on offer.
Not all vending machines are alike. A very special vending machine in Berlin Mitte offers luxury products and is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The machine was created in response to limited German opening hours, even for grocery stores. But now, if you need a half bottle of champagne on a Sunday at 12:30, no problem. Just go to Jägerstrasse in Berlin Mitte, and there you will find the Floris catering machine. Sitting outside next to it, its owner, Floris Vlasman, shared more about this very special machine and why and how it came to be.
This is an old dream when I was young. Yeah, originally I'm Dutch. As people know, perhaps when they have visited before Amsterdam, for example, you will find in high frequently regions will find snack machines in the wall where you can get some hot food out of there. And since I'm living in Germany, I just was thinking of one of those machines integrating in the German market. And in Germany, they do have other opening times for the shop. And I thought it would be a very nice thing for all the inhabitants in Berlin to also have the possibility, after the shops are closed, still doing their, some buys. We have a very hard closing and opening time market generally in Germany, so you won't find any shops which are open out of the time, Monday, Friday. Yeah, most of the shops open at 9 o'clock in the morning, some already at 8 o'clock, but they all do close at 7 or at 8 o'clock in the night. So, yeah, where to go then? Yeah, in Berlin, okay, you have some little possibilities, like on the filling station, gas station, yeah, you can buy some stuff meanwhile, but not this extraordinary high quality stuff. Yeah, you won't get, only in one place, and that's in our shop. We have 10 different possibilities to buy 10 different products out of this machine. So there's a machine staying in front of our shop, and you can entrance 24 hours, 7 days by your credit card or by your EC card. You can entrance like in a normal bank situation, where you can get some money out of the wall. And in this machine, you don't get money out of the wall, but you get, at the moment, 10 different present packages in a culinary style. And it's starting from 150 euro at the moment up to 19.50 euro. But therefore, you already get half a bottle of champagne, for example. So the idea was, for having different possibilities, what to do after 8 o'clock in the night and having forgotten the present on the way to the birthday.
The machine first got a lot of press, and then it got a lot of customers. You could say that this vending machine has cornered the after-hours high-end culinary market in Berlin.
What are the most successful sellers? At the moment, really, it's the champagne is running very well, because it's in a half-sized bottle and it's really cooled down to 4 or 5 degrees, so like it should be. Further, our salt mixtures in different perfumes in a little present box, about you can pack it yourself, but you will find it all in the machine. We have some delicious chocolate bars, which run also very well, and our, for sure, nut mixtures in different styles. It's the strangest moments they do come, because we are self-opening in our shop on Monday till Friday in the time 10 till 7 o'clock in the evening, and on Saturday we do open at 10 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's very different. Sometimes buying or the seller selling in the machine is done at midnight, sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, sometimes even at 6 o'clock in the morning. So for very early people, perhaps after the party, where the stuff was running out, then you also can find our machine for the last bottles of champagne if you're running out, or your fridge in your hotel room is empty, already, because you had already the party, but you want to have an after-show party, then you can fill up your fridge with our fridge.
So the next time you're in Berlin, growing desperate because all of the wine shops are closed and that grocery store White Zinfandel just won't do, you can visit the 24/7 Floris Feinkost vending machine and buy a nice half bottle of wine. The machine is popular with the expat crowd, and when I later told Garrett Whitmore, an American management consultant, that the Floris vending machine existed, he was quick to explain his own grocery frustrations about living in Berlin.
really you have no options in Berlin. Either you plan your dinner party on Friday and Saturday and make your shopping then, or you don't have a dinner party. You invite friends to go out to a restaurant, and that's pretty much your only option, really, other than the two train stations, which offer you a cornucopia of dried meat and wine in a box.
And to fantasize a bit about his ideal florist vending machine fillings.
Foie gras. Foie gras, good wine. I have to think of foods that don't need cooking or preparation. I mean, if there were good cuts of meat that were available that I could, you know, pull a nice ribeye steak out and bring it home and grill it, that would be nice.
For the love of foie gras or champagne from a vending machine, and for Monocle in Berlin, I'm Jessica Bridger.
Edition of The Menu tonight at 1900 hours London time.
In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this with a look at what's making the headlines in Belgrade.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 8:41 here in London, 9:41 in Belgrade, which is where we're heading now. Joining us on the line is Monocle's Guy Delaunay. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Hello there.
We hear you've broken your arm in two places. Very sorry to hear that.
Thank you very much. I'll take all the sympathy I can get.
Quite. It's extremely heroic of you to be on the show, so we're very glad
you haven't
to
done
have
it in the last 5 minutes, have you, Guy?
In the last 5 days.
Well, speedy recovery.
Speedy Thank recovery. Let's start with Serbia becoming an associate member of the EU tomorrow. This is quite significant, isn't it?
Indeed it is. I mean, who would have thought it, really? It's barely a decade since Serbia was governed by the Milosevic government, which, of course, was extremely autocratic and attracted unflattering attention from the whole world, not least NATO, which bombed Belgrade in 1999. And you can still see the effects as you walk around the city. But now the country is firmly on the path to EU membership. This becoming an EU associate member means that basically membership negotiations are underway, and that sooner or later, probably later, Serbia will become a member of the European Union.
What is the mood in Serbia towards accession to the EU? I mean, obviously, from the point of view of the EU, it is an enlarged membership of an already big body. Mm. But what is it? Is there a sort of a remaining pull towards the east and a pull towards the west at the same time?
Well, yes, there is. I think if this had happened 10 years ago, people would have been very excited, because 10 years ago, people were still quite thrilled at the ouster of the Milosevic government. They were very optimistic under the government of Zoran Djindjic. They thought that Serbia could go in a completely different direction, and of course the EU would have been a big part of that. Now, of course, Djindjic was assassinated in 2003. There was a lot of stagnation over the succeeding years, and then the enormous economic turndown in Europe led to people questioning what they really wanted. And you're right, there is a pull to the east. Russia has significant ties with Serbia in religion. Both follow the Orthodox Christian religion. They both consider themselves part of the sort of brotherhood of Slavic nations, and so that's very strong. But this whole process towards membership talks with the European Union has been driven by the most powerful politician in Serbia, Serbia, Aleksandar Vučić, who is the first deputy prime minister, if you please. And he's basically said, look, we've been friends with Russia, we'll always be friends with Russia, but I'm telling them, as I'm telling everybody else, we belong in the European Union. We're a European nation. That's where we want to be. And this process really is being used and seen by the current government as a way of modernizing and changing Serbia, much as in the same way some countries use the Olympics as a way of modernizing cities and infrastructure. Serbia is looking at EU membership in much the same way.
Now, associate membership is clearly, as you say, a big landmark step, but what sort of obstacles lie in Serbia's path on the way to full membership?
Well, I think when people think about Serbia, generally unflattering words come up. They think about rule of law, they think about corruption, they think about an economy which is fairly dire, to tell you the truth. So all of those things need to be tackled. Some of them have been progressively addressed over the past decade and a half. Others need more urgent attention, and all of that's got to be gone through with the European Union. If Serbia wants to accede, it'll have to go through what they call 35 chapters. And each of those chapters addresses a particular issue. So every one of those, and you know what EU bureaucracy can be like, Serbia is going to have to address all of it. Now, very brave people, they think this is going to be good for their country. And you can see their point partly, but you also think there's going to be a lot of gnashing of teeth, bearing in mind the way things are done here is often quite off the cuff.
Well, sincerely hoping that by 2020 the European Union's problems will be a little less and Serbia will have got through those 35 barriers. Who have they got doing this? There's a big reshuffle planned for the government, isn't there? And you know, one wonders whether the timing is altogether coincidental.
Probably not. This reshuffle that we're talking about, the parliamentary debate is due to begin in about 15 minutes over whether to accept these ministerial changes. And of course, everybody expects that these changes will be accepted. Now, I mentioned before, first Deputy Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić. I mean, this is, if anybody remembers British city politics of the 1980s, Liverpool City Council in the 1980s caused a lot of headlines because it was in direct opposition to the Thatcher government. And the person who was leading that was Derek Hatton. But he was actually the deputy leader of the city council. Serbia has a similar situation. Aleksandar Vučić is the first deputy prime minister, but he's in charge. There's no question about it. This reshuffle is leaving him still as first deputy prime minister. He says he doesn't want to become prime minister without elections, which aren't likely to happen for the moment. He's still in partnership with the socialists of Prime Minister Ivica Dacic, who are the junior partner in the coalition. But what they've done is they've given the third partner in the coalition, the United Regions of Serbia, the heave-ho. So this is a consolidation of power by the socialists and the progressives led by Vučić. And we're also seeing a simplification of Serbia's government. They're reducing the number of ministries, and this perhaps is part of the streamlining process, just the very start of this EU accession process we're seeing.
Never did I ever imagine we'd mention Derek Hatton on Monocle 24. Thank
like
you
that.
So much
Liverpool
for that,
Council in the 80s. There's a throwback we weren't expecting. Guy, let's change tack a little bit and talk about a music festival happening in Croatia.
Yeah, this is it. If I hadn't broken my arm in two places, I might have been in Pula today and over the weekend as well, because it's the Outlook Music Festival that's taking place in Pula, which is this town on the Istrian coast of Croatia, which has a Roman amphitheatre, absolutely glorious. It's got an old Habsburg fort up on the hill as well. And these are two of the venues for the Outlook Music Festival, which has become a mainstay of the European festival scene and part of a big part of Croatia's proposition, you might say. It's one of these things which is very much embraced by the Croatian government, by the local population, because it brings that late season tourism boost into the country, you know, end of August, early September, just when you think everything's dying off. They've got these two big festivals, Outlook, followed rapidly by Dimensions, bringing in a lot of people, particularly from Britain.
Guy Delaney, thank you very much indeed.
Wish we were going.
So do I. I wish I hadn't broken your arm, Guy. You could have taken us there. It was Guy Delaney, Monocle's man in Belgrade, hoping that the Belgrade health system sorts his arm out.
Minutes past the hour here in London. In just a moment, we will be flicking through this morning's Italian front pages with Monocle's David Pleasant. But before we do, we have time for a little music. This is currently number 11 on the Italian music charts. It's Lorenzo Jovanotti Cherubini with Estate.
Vedo nuvole in Familia. Estate, estate. Ma che caldo, ma che caldo fa.
Charming stuff. You can see why it's number 11 on the Italian music charts.
And you wonder what number 10 plus is.
That was Estate. All American rubbish, I think.
Great.
With apologies to any big fans of American pop out there. That was Estate by Lorenzo Giovanotti Cherubini. You're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Emma Nelson. And at 52 minutes past the hour, it is time for us to have a flick through this morning's front pages. And today, we are turning our attention to La Bella Italia. Joining us in the studio is Monocle researcher David Pleasant. Good morning, David. Lovely to see you.
Good morning, Clemency.
Well, first of all, let's start with Syria, because it's all over the global press this morning. What's been Italy's reaction to the UK Parliament saying no to intervention?
Well, obviously, yeah, all eyes on that parliamentary debate of last night. I think it's kind of affirmed the Italian stance that was kind of evident before that. Emma Bonino, the foreign minister, interestingly in a CNN interview last night that's being quoted all over the Italian press, is saying that she doesn't see Italy intervening in what is already a powder keg. She seems to be kind of supporting the British parliamentary position. Interestingly, there's a nice piece of article in the Panorama magazine as well that's from 2 days ago. Kind of, it's just going along the same lines, preempting what Emma Bonino's just said, saying, you know, Italy is already in a weak position. There's no point in intervening in something that perhaps Italy might have intervened in a few years ago.
It does beg the question, why is Italy now moving away from a position which is traditionally towards the United States and the United Kingdom and France? I mean, Italy was used as a launch pad for airstrikes on Libya a couple of years ago. It has always been sort of part of the group. You mentioned that Emma Bonino sort of striking departure. What have been the reasons for this, the long-term reasons?
Well, I think it has to be the decline of the economy. A nice piece by Marco Ventura. He says, Italy is weak and becoming weaker, but the voice of the small one seems to be the right one. The main reasons has to be economic and influential. Quite interestingly, some people point to the kind of ex-colonial ambitions of Britain and France. I don't think Italy has quite that kind of impetus to kind of meddle. In fact, in the last few years, and you're right to talk about Libya, Italy's seen itself as somewhat of a mediator and something that the Arab world can kind of come to the table and talk to, perhaps more than some of the more American-aligned powers.
David, shall we move on to a story you've picked up in Corriere della Sera?
Yeah, and this is all over. I mean, I have to say that despite the situation in Syria, all the papers have the first kind of several pages devoted to Berlusconi's, the latest ongoing troubles over his conviction.
Will there ever be a day, do you think, when Silvio Berlusconi is not on the front page of the Italian press?
As long as he's alive, I don't think so. So this is really on that kind of the crux of the matter is really whether he is going to be disqualified from being a life senator. He said to eliminate me would be a fatal blow to democracy in a chat show last night on one of his own channels.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. You couldn't make it up. And is there any is there still a sustained interest in him? Or is this something that he positions himself within the media in order to make sure that the story continues?
I think, and the way that the press kind of reporting this, he's almost become this kind of giant pawn where whatever he says...
No pun intended.
How do you spell pawn?
P-A-W-N.
Thank you.
So whatever he says is really irrelevant. It's basically all the kind of to-ing and fro-ing within the coalition that, you know, people are still supporting him and people are not. And whatever the judgment that is decided will have a huge impact on the coalition, no doubt.
Let's move on to the issue of, well, we're just completing the end of the tourist season in Italy. The Chinese have been enjoying the French hospitality for a very, very long time, they're now turning to their sights on Italian tourism.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, this isn't exactly new. It's been going on for quite a few years. But La Repubblica's decided to do a big double page spread, just kind of highlighting where they're spending their money on and what where they're visiting. Stop off points on the itinerary. Perhaps you wouldn't imagine. Obviously, there's Venice, Rome, the Amalfi Coast, and so on. But also San Marino. They love the idea of a small country up in the mountains with only a few thousand inhabitants. That's a kind of a must see for most Chinese.
Telling that the headline here is Poca arte e tanto shopping. I mean, obviously, Italy is a shopping destination. You think of fashion, you think of food. But is that what they're going for in this tanto shopping?
Exactly. Tanto shopping. So a lot of these itineraries are stopping off at these outlet centres that have been constructed specifically for, you know, fleets of coaches.
Why does that depress me so much?
It's happened absolutely everywhere in Europe nowadays. It is a nightmare. There's this big capital outside London, isn't there? The Bicester Shopping Centre, which is apparently 65% of all the people who go there are Chinese.
Yes, but you might argue that England doesn't have quite Italy's historical artistic treasures that you might go and see. You know, so if you go to Bluewater or Bicester, you know, you're not. It's just depressing about going to Italy and going to an outlet mall.
It is, but you just have to weigh up whether it actually is money going back into the Italian economy. If they're there, they'll spend money, and then maybe Italy one day might feel a little bit better.
Monocle's David Pleasant. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, because that is it for Midori House this morning. Thank you to our producer Phil Hahn, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elias Simos, and our studio manager Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is Section D. Phil Hahn and Marcus Hippie will be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. But meanwhile, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And from me, Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.